pleasure to be here at Perimeter to talk about my work. Thanks for the invitation. And I'm going to tell you about some work that's just appeared on the archive in collaboration with Steve Simon, Chris Hooley, and Jonathan Keeling. And whilst ongoing, I hope this will give you a snapshot of what we've been up to and where we hope this sort of approach will take us in the end. We've just scratched the surface, I think, but I hope that we'll convince you that this is a productive avenue of new way to look at strongly correlated quantum systems. So, well, there are a lot of words here. This is just the abstract that I sent out. But it summarizes the main point of our work, which is to try and combine insights from tensor networks with field theory. Entanglement is absolutely fundamental to quantum mechanics. And of course, this has been realized since the dawn of quantum mechanics with the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox and Bell's inequalities. But it's only really in the last decade or so that people like Giuffre and Steve White have taught us how to use insights about entanglement to make progress in describing strongly correlated quantum states. On the other hand, Feynman path integrals give a complementary set of insights about quantum mechanics, but they're based upon states that are not entangled at all. Indeed, it's because they're made of sequences of classical states that the Feynman path integral allows us to see how classical mechanics emerges from an underlying quantum mechanics. We actually have to work quite hard to describe entanglement structures within a conventional path integral. And our goal here in this work has been to combine the ideas of tensor networks with path integrals so that we get the power and the insights of both. So here's the outline of the material that I hope to get through. The main point is to get across the thrust of this idea and a couple of examples. And so I'll start with, well, I'll probably go rather rapidly through this given the background of people in this room. But these two sections will give the central aim and the central construction that we're trying to work with. And then I'll give a couple of illustrative examples. I have a general formulation of our path integral over matrix product states, which will be of some technical interest, but in a way, depending on time, if I don't have time for this, perhaps you can ask me about it later. I think this section, my discussion and conclusion, will give me a chance to talk about the possible links that this might have to the exciting work on entanglement renormalization and geometry of entanglement structure that's being done by others here in Perimeter and elsewhere. Okay, so this is a heuristic picture of the path integral. So, of course, the path integral is constructed from sequences of classical field configurations. And because of this, the saddle point configurations of this field integral are product states. They have no entanglement. The only way to put entanglement into such a picture is to do perturbative corrections to the saddle point or instanton corrections to the saddle point. Of course, one can calculate entanglements by calculating correlators in more sophisticated spaces, but in the native space, these are the tools we have to look at entanglement in field theory. So let me be a bit more specific. So if we're constructing a path integral, say, for some transition amplitude or a partition function, basically we divide the time translation operator into lots of little steps and insert resolutions of the identity. And this is where our choice of product states comes in, because we normally take these states to be product states of coherent states at each point in space. And if you do this, then you always end up with the following sort of action, where you have a bit, a Berry phase bit, that comes from the difference in states at two points in time, and an expectation of a Hamiltonian. And the question here is, can we do the same with weakly entangled states? Well, of course, the answer is yes. This A indicates a matrix product state. And whilst this may be glib, I just want to give a sense of how straightforward this central idea is. Of course, we can construct a path integral with a sequence of weakly entangled states. There's no impediment to that. All we required of our product states in order to construct our path integral was that the states were overcomplete, so we could write a resolution of the identity. And actually, the degree of overcompleteness tells us how smooth the paths are in time. And I'll return to that a little bit later when I talk about instantons and tunneling contributions. In principle, we can write this sort of thing down. And of course, the devil is in the detail, and coming up with a construction that does this is what most of this talk will be about. There are several immediate questions. What is this measure over our matrix product states? Is this theory even local? Normally, when we write down a path integral or a field theory, we like to have a local Lagrangian density. And of course, these sorts of objects, in principle, are not local at all. A thing that we wrestled with for a while is, what is this Berry phase? How should we interpret it? I mean, the Berry phase over coherent states has a nice geometrical interpretation. Of course, we expect the same thing here. This question will probably be answered with the most clarity in the general formulation that I hope I'll have time to get to towards the end. But before I go on to doing this in a little more detail, let me say what we hope to gain from this. So the saddle points of such a field integral are simply the time-dependent variational principle over the variational manifold defined by the set of states that we make our resolution of the identity over. Of course, when we use product states in the usual case for field theory, we just call those saddle point equations the semi-classical equations of motion. But they are, in a sense, a time-dependent variational principle constructed over product states. By constructing a field integral in this way, immediately we see that the saddle points will contain physics that isn't contained in the saddle point of a product state field integral. Now, moreover, and perhaps I'll get back to this later, they're not always, the saddle points of such a field integral are not always adiabatically connected or adiabatically continuous with product state field configurations. And in a sense, that's where the power of this comes from. You can have qualitatively different states as saddle points of such a field integral, states that perhaps you'd miss in working with a conventional field integral. And this is sort of where the power comes from, and I'll say more about this later, but the having a higher bond order field integral like this means that the saddle point actually resums sets of instanton contributions to the field theory at lower bond order. Which is to say that, you know, if you form a singlet from two spins, that's tunneling between, you know, two product state configurations, that one would be described within a conventional field theory by some instanton. And that physics can be captured already at bond order 2. So it's clear that a rather low bond order field integral might capture features and physics that is only contained in such contributions to the conventional field integral. And this shows up. I have an example that's a sort of toy model of deconfined criticality that I'll go through. So let me get down to some details. The technical background I'll go through rather quickly given the audience here. What I'm actually going to do, my set of states that I'm going to construct my field integral over is simply matrix product states. And one thing that's quite useful in thinking about what we mean by our path integral is to consider the manifold over which the dynamics of such states is confined. I already said that the saddle point equations of our field integral are the time-dependent variational principle. And this is simply the following. If we take a point on some manifold that's defined by some fixed maximum for its bond order, Hamiltonian evolution will generally take us out of that manifold. And we can continually project back in several ways, but let's say based upon the optimizing the fidelity with a point on this manifold at every instant. And if we do that, we get this time-dependent variational principle, which is simply an inner product of the Schrodinger equation with some tangent vector to this manifold. And in a sense, these manifolds are a manifold of semi-classical states, in the sense that, well, first of all, there's a polynomial number of numbers here, number of variables describing our system. And in that sort of trivial sense, this is a classical set of equations. But actually, the time-dependent variational principle, one can associate with this dynamics a Poisson bracket structure and a Hamiltonian evolution. And so if in our field integral, in order to capture qualitative features of our system, we require a bond order other than one, then one could say that the tensors of this of our field integral or our path integral are emergent classical coordinates for our system. Okay. So I've already said that in a sense, the working at a certain bond order resums instanton configurations. But let me expand upon this a little bit. And actually, the simplest example I have of that is this two-spin case that I talked about a moment ago. So one can, of course, cover the Hilbert space of two spins with a bond order two matrix product state. And here I've just parameterized it in a particular way with two SU2 fields that describe, if you like, coherent states on each of the spins, and an SU2 field that describes the entanglement between those two spins. And actually, if you look at the dynamics of these two spins under some Heisenberg Hamiltonian, you find that an antiferromagnetic Heisenberg Hamiltonian, say, starting with this state, up down, you find that there's no dynamics at all for the spin coherent states. All of the dynamics is in an entanglement. You tunnel between up down and down up. And this I've shown here. This is an O3 vector got from a Hopf map from the this SU2 spinner, and it simply rotates in a particular plane under the action of this Hamiltonian. Actually, if you couple to some local bath, you can see how this entanglement decays and you gradually relax to the singlet configuration. Okay, so if I want in a new usual coherent state integral for this, I could only capture this sort of physics by looking at instantons and bounce trajectories and so on. I would have to take imaginary time excursions of my in my field integral in order to get at this physics. But it's all automatically contained if I construct a path integral using all of these variables. Then I just get at this physics, this dynamics of tunneling trajectories and so on, immediately from the equations of motion. And that's sort of the idea here, that if you increase the bond order a little, one has access to perhaps the key additional physics, which maybe in many condensed matter cases is the physics of singlets and dynamics of singlets. So. Again, in other words, the matrix product state, or a tensor network, is a sum of product states. And in a sense, one can think of a product state, an instanton in a product state field theory is required when there is no real-time trajectory that takes you between two product state field configurations. But the matrix product description can contain both of those product state field configurations with some relative weight. And simply, there can be a real-time trajectory that tunes between the two. So in that way, you can capture these tunneling trajectories. And in fact, as you increase bond order, you have more and more intricate types of instanton and tunneling paths that you can take, where the intermediate states are sums of more and more product state field configurations. And one might imagine, actually, that if you have a fairly local Hamiltonian, perhaps the instanton or the tunneling trajectories that you require are not that intricate, and perhaps the qualitative features of those tunneling trajectories are already captured at low bond order. Okay, so the final thing I'd like to say, this final bit of technical background, is about locality of our field integral and the contractibility of our tensor network. So, of course, when we calculate the expectation of some local operator with a matrix product state, formally, this is not a local object at all. But in one dimension, We know that we can summarize the effect of this contraction to the left-hand side and this contraction to the right-hand side by a finite number of numbers. And that finite contractibility allows us to construct a local field theory. We have to do this by introducing additional variables. But crucially, there's a finite number of additional variables that we need to introduce. So our field integral will be over the tensors, the matrix product tensors, and these variables, these environment variables that are given by these sorts of equations imposed by some functional delta function.
Sorry, could you explain what you mean by an?
By? An. An is the tensor of a matrix product state, which may vary in space. So if I go back to just my... the matrix product state is, if you like, you endow the complex coefficients of a product state with additional auxiliary indices. So instead of being just numbers, two complex numbers for each spin, we have a matrix of numbers that we can contract along the chain. And that the size of those tensors tells us about this bond order that I keep talking about. And in a sense, that is allowing us to describe a with greater and greater accuracy a point in Hilbert space as we increase that bond order. But it's also, if I take a particular configuration of these auxiliary indices, it will correspond to a particular product state. And in that sense, this sum of these auxiliary indices is a sum over product state configurations. And that's where the power of this is coming from. Okay. So this finite contractibility is absolutely essential for us to construct a local path integral. And of course, it's not the case for PEPs. So the natural generalization of matrix product states to higher dimensions is not finitely contractible, and the construction I'm going to show you doesn't work. It does work for something like MIRA or other cases that I'll talk about later. Okay. So with these comments, we're now in a position to actually construct this path integral. And these are the three questions that I was asking myself. What's the measure? Is the theory local? And what is the Berry phase? Well, one way to think about constructing a measure here would be to simply try and come up with an explicit parametrization of the matrix product tensors at a given bond order. And that can be made to work, actually, but it's really horrendously messy. I mean, our aim here was to do analytical calculations, and it's simply not a useful approach. But rather than do that, one can go use, instead of matrix product states, one can use matrix product operators. So what do I mean by this? So this would indicate a simple coherent state for a single spin. And one could perfectly well, instead of integrating over this SU2 spinner, one could instead take the action of some SU2 field, some SU2 matrix on some reference state. And we still know how to construct an unbiased measure over such SU2 operators, just a Haar measure. So with the matrix product states, we can do something very similar. We can go to a matrix product operator. So I've given each of these tensors now has an additional index, as well as the spin index it had to start with. It has another spin index, which connects to the reference state. And we can always interpret such a state as a unitary transformation from this combined auxiliary spin space to this new auxiliary spin space. And actually, there's an implicit gauge fixing here in doing this. You can see I could combine this this spin and auxiliary space. I could combine it in this way, or I could combine it in this way. And that's two different gauge fixings. But once I've done that, then I can take these tensors to be elements of this larger SU2 group. So SU little d, where little d is the local Hilbert space dimension, and big D, where this is the auxiliary, the bond dimension, the bond order. So simply by collecting together the indices in this way. And of course, we know how to write down an unbiased measure over elements of SUN. So in principle, that gives us our measure. And the locality, I already said a few words about that, but we essentially rewrite our field integral, where we introduce these extra fields that describe the at a given site end the effect of contracting the network all the way to the left of the given site. With the gaze fixing that I've chosen on the right-hand side, we just get the identity. So now, in terms of this lambda and this A, we're going to get a finite field theory. And that's essentially it. I mean, we enhance our path integral with these additional variables that we constrain by this functional delta function. And this F here is simply this sum here, the usual update of the environment from one site to the next along a matrix product state. And yes?
Sorry, you said this is a field theory?
I use the word field theory, and I should be careful and say path integral. It's discrete in space.
But you have some variables that become fields on each site? In which set?
In the sense, if you wrote down a coherent state path integral for some lattice magnet, one might call that a field theory loosely, but of course it's a path integral for a lattice system. I have a habit that I should avoid of being rather loose with the language and calling that a field theory. But it's really a path integral because we're spatially discrete always. Yeah.
The question is, what are the classical fields you're integrating over?
Well, these classical fields are these matrices of our tensor. They're time dependent. Time dependent and potentially spatially dependent over the lattice as well.
So the time is continuous in this
yes.
path integral?
Yes.
And when you have an integral over A,
yes.
that means for each charge of time,
yes.
an integral over MTS.
Yes.
The content of that.
Yes, exactly. Precisely.
Yeah. The size of the matrix doesn't change over time, right?
We choose to keep that fixed. Yeah, we choose to keep that fixed. Precisely.
So it's a matrix.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So in a sense, this is a complicated path integral, but it's rather conventional as well. It's just the interpretation of the fields that go into it that's different from the interpretation that one would usually place on the elements of your path integral.
And lambda is also a UI matrix.
Lambda is actually, let me see, is a D by D matrix.
Small, yeah.
Yeah, slightly, it's different dimension to A, actually.
Big D.
Lambda only has these auxiliary indices. It doesn't have any spin indices. Yes?
May I ask a question? So, I think probably explained it, but I missed it. So what does the resolution identity look like with A and lambda?
Okay, I've not given it explicitly here. Basically, what I've said is that we know how to write a Haar measure over these SU little d times big D matrices. And so in principle, we know how to write the measure. So it's the measure for SU. So the resolution of the identity is an integral with the Haar measure over these, and then simply an outer product of the two matrix product states with the same, with that tensor in place.
Excellent.
Yeah. You have to worry a little bit about orthogonalization at the ends and so on, but that can be done. Okay, so as I said, this is in principle this is a conventional path integral, and the Berry phase is actually spatially local with this parameterization as well, and one can go the next step, next logical step here in a way is to give an explicit parameterization of this field integral. And to, I guess implicitly in the question that I just answered, to write out exactly what this action and so on looked like. But I think it's actually more illuminating if at this point I shift to giving a couple of examples and show what the potential gain is from using this type of structure in constructing a path integral.
Before you do that, in your initial, there was an initial expression for a path integral for Cartesian state.
Yes.
Where you had the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Appear between psi and psi.
Yes.
And now you replace that with NPS, NPS.
Yes.
But is this NPS on both sides the same?
Yes, it is. So in the usual way of constructing the path integral, so of course when you construct the path integral, what you find is that the states on either side should be states at slightly different instances. But in fact, the error in taking them to be the same instant is higher order in the time step. Then,
because and they're already visualizing families of states which evolve in time smoothly, right?
Yes, yes.
I see.
Yeah.
And this picture does not need to be updated in the presence of...
So interesting, of course, when that goes wrong is when you have discontinuous changes in your path, and which is to say when you have tunneling between different states. And so if you take a coherent state path integral for spin halves, precisely when your Hamiltonian induces lots of singlet-type physics, that may go wrong. But in fact, when you go to, say, bond order 2, you can already describe singlets in the saddle point configurations, in the smooth saddle point configurations. So actually, that approximation is a better approximation with the higher bond order. I mean, there are, of course, I can construct it. Say I stick at bond order 2, there are still instantons in this field theory, which is to say there are more intricate tunneling trajectories.
I'm thinking about the word approximation, better approximation versus.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I thought this was an exact problem.
Yeah, no. So, in the sense that, so of course, there's always this assumption in constructing a path integral. When we write, I mean, particularly in the Berry phase, when we write the state overlap with the time derivative of the state, that's actually the difference between the state at two consecutive instants of time. And you make an assumption that those trajectories are smooth and continuous in time. And sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes you get tunneling, which tunneling doesn't have a continuous evolution of the classical variables.
I'm sorry, I don't understand this thing. You just mm-hmm. have path integral
yeah.
that you produce by inserting resolutions of the identity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no approximation.
There's no approximation in that. Yeah.
So then...
Well, one always, when writing down a precise... Where, let me get back to a slide that has it in, just to... So this is actually, this thing here, is really the difference in my my state at two consecutive instants of time. And I guess an implicit assumption when you treat these spin systems with path integrals is that you can rewrite that as a time derivative. And that's, you know, that's...
But the time derivative already implies that you take your configurations of the field.
It implies that, so there can be cases where the physics is such that the real saddle point of this field integral is not one that's described by a continuous evolution of the classical variables. And in that case, at that point, you can't really write these down as derivatives in real time. I mean, at that point, you have to take these, you know, you can avoid that by taking some excursion into imaginary time and doing calculating an instanton. And my point is that you don't have to include those. If you work at some finite bond order, because you're already including instantons at some level, the occasions where you have to make these imaginary time excursions are fewer.
But is that the main point of your work there?
In a sense, yes. In a sense, it gives you anywhere where the physics is contained in proliferation of instantons, now you get at this by some semi-classical field configuration that's already present.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry. Configurations that were classical in the product state picture, in the one that you learned, are they still semi-classical in this picture? Or are there instantons in this picture, or are they something...
So just a classical field configuration in the coherent state is a coherent state is a subset of a very sparse subset of these matrix product states. So it's, that physics is already contained. Actually, maybe the examples will answer your question about what is the point. I mean, in a sense, that is the point, but why it's useful. So. I'm going to, rather than using the general parameterization here, I'm going to immediately restrict myself to a rather sparse matrix product state. And the point is that any entanglement in the path integral will accommodate some new physics. So I'm going to use a restricted bond order 3 matrix product state that captures local magnetic order and singlets. And this matrix product state can be written like this. So I have, for each site, I have an SU2 coherent state-like field. And this is just the one that's polarized in the opposite direction. And then I have an SU2 field that describes the entanglement between, the entanglement to the left of the given site in the way I've written this. And you can see that this thing describes the entanglement because if you calculate what the environment tensor is for this this type of matrix product state, you find it's just this diagonal matrix where L doesn't appear, but this N spinner does, the two components of this thing appear. And we have a global parameter, lambda, that actually this thing alternates from site to site, but it's so it goes from lambda to 1 minus lambda on adjacent sites. But this lambda is essentially telling us about the relative weighting of the two different singlet decorations of the line. So in higher dimensions, this will be a more, will take values at every point on the lattice, but in 1D, it's just a, it's a global parameter. And this Berry phase that I was worrying about before takes a rather simple form in this particular parameterization. So you can see that there's a Berry phase coming from the entanglement dynamics. There's the usual Berry phase coming from the coherent state dynamics, but it's modulated by the degree to which the given spin is entangled with its neighbors. And I'm going to use this to look at a couple of example problems. So the first one is a toy model of deconfined criticality. So this is simply an anti-ferromagnetic Hamiltonian on a square lattice, but where the we have a different coupling constant on these A and B sublattices. So the A is a ladder, and the B is just some additional rungs that connect those ladders together. Yes?
The first lattice one very quickly. If you just had lambda and no n's, what kinds of states are those in?
I can't really write down without. Oh, you mean just take, say, n to be like 1 over square root 2?
Yeah,
one
of, and no lambda.
They would be, that would then describe just singlet or s equals 0 triplet configurations.
The product states between.
So lambda. If lambda is equal to a half, then you're equally entangled to the left and the right. So it can describe, there's no magnetic order then.
Is
when
that
you,
the AKL state?
It can capture the AKL, sorry, not the, it can capture the Majum de Gauche state, not AKLT, because this is spin half. Yeah. But actually, one of the reasons we wrote this down is because we know it captures the Majum de Gauche state.
I'm still having difficulty understanding this simple example. So, mm-hmm. Is this a matrix product state?
It is, yes. So all I've done, I write it in this way, just where basically this is a tensor on each site, and I'm using a sort of Dirac notation for the spin bits, and just
that's a single tensor.
Yes, that's a single tensor.
And
I take a string of these, and in principle, these L and N are fields that vary in space and in time.
So you are saying that it's a restricted form,
yeah,
but useful to say. But what's the replacement of the unitary constraint? The fact that you are using Hall measure, is that?
Well, so this is, I know how to write these measures over these two spinners, and actually, I can very easily write down the measure for this path integral. It's just the usual measure, SU2 measures.
But
to this.
Does this still produce a resolution of the density?
Yes, it does. So, of course, it doesn't go over all of the space that the MPS covers, but, of course, neither does the usual spin coherent state. It just covers some even smaller fraction of that space. So we've enhanced the spin coherent state with a minimal amount of entanglement here in writing down this restriction. And it just illustrates, you know, how even that little bit can give us, capture some new physics. So this Hamiltonian has a transition from a valence bond solid state. So when the anti-ferromagnetic coupling on these B rungs dominates. You just get singlets on these bonds. But when the anti-ferromagnetic coupling on the A sublattice becomes large enough, you have a nail ground state instead. And the transition between these two doesn't have a conventional Ginzburg-Landau theory. But it turns out it does have a Ginzburg-Landau-like construction in terms of this restricted MPS tensor. And we can use the MPS. You'll notice this is a 2D problem, but I've been talking about 1D matrix product tensors so far. And the point is the entanglement forms preferentially in this horizontal direction here. So we can use matrix product states in this direction to describe this state, and we construct a field integral over such states. So it's a bit of a cheat, really, with treating a 2D problem with a 1D matrix product state, because the Hamiltonian itself breaks this rotational invariance in the plane. Okay, so first of all, I can describe both of these ground states with this restricted MPS tensor. If it turns out the spin coherent state part, I just take an anti-ferromagnetic configuration for it. And the only thing that varies between these two states is the configuration of this entanglement field, this N. And it goes from being NZ equal to 1, which is to say that the spin-up component of N is 1 and the spin-down component is 0. And that's just a product state. That's the nail state. And the Anusha's question, what about this state? Well, this, in this case, gives us the valence bond solid state. Okay. So moreover, if we calculate the expectation of this Hamiltonian with our restricted matrix product tensor, we find that the Z component of this entanglement field is an order parameter for this transition. It goes from being 0 here to being gradually going up to 1 in the nail state. Okay, so in a sense, this restricted parameterization actually is a translationally invariant version of bond operators. And it's the Hamiltonian we're looking at here is not translationally invariant, so we didn't really need it. You could have got this with bond operators. But this is just to show that there are problems where in a conventional field theory, we have to do, to describe this type of critical point, you typically find that the Lagrange multipliers that impose various constraints on your fields become the dynamical variables at the critical point. And the field theory is the field theory, it's an emergent gauge theory of those Lagrange multipliers, if you like. Here, actually, one can construct an effective theory over this entanglement field. And this, if you like, is the critical theory of this transition. And it will be dual to an emergent gauge description. So the potential here is that using a matrix product field theory, one gets a complementary picture of this type of physics. One can see that we have a Ginzburg-Landau order parameter for this transition. It is an entanglement field. But of course, entanglement isn't something that you can measure directly in experiments. So it's not an order parameter as envisaged by Ginzburg and Landau. It's a rather unconventional order parameter. But once we've identified that, we can describe this sort of transition. And that in part, Jouffroy, is why this was the point, that you can capture, already at low bond order, you capture physics that one has to use different approaches to describe in the usual field theory. Okay, so this problem was really, it was 2D, but it was artificially 2D because the Hamiltonian actually breaks the symmetry down so we can use a 1D matrix product state. What we'd like to do is look at this JQ model, which is a 2D model that has actually the same transition, and numerically at least seems to really have a continuous transition between the two. We can't do this using PEPs, perhaps. It would be the natural generalization of these matrix product states, but because PEPs are not finitely contractible, it's very difficult. But we can do this using instead of using matrix product states for our field integral, using finite depth circuits to construct our field integral, and then we think we can make progress in this problem. Okay, but the second problem that we've managed to look at is this model, this 1D model, called the J1, J2 model, where you have nearest and next nearest neighbor interactions. And if you look at the sort of semi-classical coherent state solution of this model, you find that you go from a region of ferromagnetic order to a region of anti-ferromagnetic order via a spiral phase where you gradually take the ferromagnet and you gradually twist it until it's actually become an anti-ferromagnet. And in the middle here, there's a Majum de Gauche point that's an exact ground state of this Hamiltonian. Now, in fact, it turns out that on around this point on either side here, you get some, with the incommensurate modulation of the magnetic order, you also get some dimerization beginning to occur. And that's very hard to capture, say, with bond operators. But here, we can actually see this physics using our matrix product ansatz. We can actually see this physics emerging by a sort of quantum order by disorder mechanism that determines the entanglement structure. So this slide summarizes what goes on here. Remember, I had this global parameter lambda that I said told me about the relative weighting of the two different singlet decorations of the line. And if I calculate the expectation of my Hamiltonian with my ansatz, I find that it doesn't depend on lambda at all. This thing here is the rotation of the spiral configuration of the magnet in the coherent state picture. But if I calculate zero-point fluctuations about the state determined in this way, I find that there is a dependence on lambda. And this says that zero-point fluctuations, on one side, they drive you to lambda is equal to a half. And on the other side, they drive you to either lambda equals zero or lambda equals one, which is to say that you favor one dimerization over the other. So you break the translational symmetry. There's a Z2 breaking of the translational symmetry. And that's very difficult to describe in this region where you have an incommensurate spiral. You have incommensurate spiral order and the dimerization occurring. So one can see how using this type of matrix product half integral method, one can begin to see how conventional field theory ideas, like this idea of order by disorder, can tell you about how quantum fluctuations can determine the entanglement structure in your system. And perhaps this will be a useful idea in the future. Okay, so I think I'm going to spend a few minutes now going through this general formulation. I may go through this quite quickly because this is slightly more technical, and if anyone has questions about it, then I'm around the next 2 days. Yes?
Before the general formulation, can you clarify whether your use of matrix product states was not equivalent to one on DMRG, where you just take that as a regional ansatz for the ground state?
So the point is that what you get from DMRG is when you stop it at some bond order, what you get, that is the saddle point of a field integral at that bond order.
That's the saddle point. And
yes.
So
we're calculating fluctuations around it, and we can see how the fluctuations around it can you know, there's a degenerate, in the problem I talked about with this J1, J2 model, if you stop at this bond order 3, you'd find a degeneracy in the matrix product states that you get out. And this field theory allows us to determine how that degeneracy is broken by higher order quantum fluctuations. And actually, it will be quite difficult to do with DMRG, because remember, it's an incommensurate spiral. So even that is tricky, I think. So these analytical approaches may have useful things to say there as well.
But at some point, you started talking about ground state.
Yes. But, by ground state, I mean time-independent saddle point of the path integral.
And are these the ground state?
They're the same ones. So if you ran DMRG at that bond order, of course, this is a restricted set of matrix product states, so you'd have to just do your DMRG over that restricted set, but they are precisely the same.
And so when your formalism are putting this in the context of path integral as contributions on top of the ground state?
Yes.
Thank you.
So the spirit of doing this sort of field integral is slightly different from the usual spirit. So normally with DMRG or whatever technique you like to use, the idea is you increase bond order until you get numerical convergence to some acceptable level. Here the idea is that you increase the bond order until you capture all the qualitative features of the system, and then you do perturbative calculations around that. And actually, these deconfined critical points are an interesting case. So when you look at, there are plenty of field theories of quantum critical points. So we know at quantum critical points, the entanglement is diverging. Yet, we do a very good job starting with product state field integrals and doing, you know, maybe using 1 over n or epsilon expansions, but doing what are essentially perturbative corrections to those saddle points, to those product state saddle points. And it's amazing that works, actually. Because to get anything numerically precise, you might think you need to start with some very high bond order. The deconfined critical points are a case where that doesn't work, where the product state field configurations are not adiabatically continuous with the actual saddle point of your field theory, in the same way as a non-Fermi liquid isn't adiabatically continuous with the Fermi gas. And so I think, you know, that's another way of saying where is the power of doing this sort of thing. It allows you to describe, take points of departure that are qualitatively different from product state saddle points. Okay, so you have to leave in 5 minutes or... trying to decide which bit I talk about first. Okay, let me talk about the Berry phase. So we worried quite a lot about this because, you know, the Berry phase has got all these this appealing geometrical structure to it, and it leads to the quantization of spin, or gives you a geometrical understanding of the quantization of spin, and it should certainly have a similar geometric interpretation in this context. So I'm going to go through this relatively slowly. So if we think about a single spin coherent state, or let's say spin coherent states, product states of spin coherent states, then the Berry phase can be written in a variety of ways. But basically, it gives you, for periodic paths, it gives you the area swept out by the spins over that periodic time interval. And we could think about doing a spin wave expansion in the vicinity of some reference state. And if we did that, the Berry phase actually takes a very simple form, just this integral of L star times L, where this is the taking the two components of L and making some complex field out of it. So notice here, my spin wave field has to be orthogonal to my reference field and so on, all the usual things. So let's think how we would treat a small path with matrix product states. So the idea is that we take our reference state, so this is playing the same role as N0, and we need to find a set of states that are orthogonal to that, and these are the tangent vectors to this variational manifold. So those of you who've used time-dependent variational principle will be very familiar with this thing and how to construct it. So what I've done here is I've taken the tensor on one site and I've changed it a little bit, and I can parameterize that by some d by d minus 1 times d matrix x. And if I do that, the Berry phase just looks like the generalization of my spin wave Berry phase, except I have this trace here. I didn't have a trace before. So the details of how to go through this construction are in various papers by Uto Hagemann, but this little x here, this matrix x, is the parameterization of this small trajectory. It's now become a time-dependent matrix field, and I can use that to parameterize these small paths. So as I said, you can compare this to the N0 in my spin wave expansion, and this thing is playing the same role as L, and these states are orthogonal to these, which is basically this condition. And you can see that this Berry phase looks rather like this one, except I have a trace here where I didn't need a trace before. Okay, so we can also, for coherent states, we can parameterize a general path and get the general Berry phase. And we can do it in a variety of ways. We can write it in this Wesimino form, or we can just write it in terms of these spinners in a form that looks like that. So what we've done, we've gone from, in our spin wave expansion, we had one complex number per site, and we constructed our Berry phase like this. Now we have two complex numbers. So we have this spin index as well. And so we might guess, we might anticipate, that for the matrix product state version, we still have this trace form here, but we just put this additional spin index on here. So actually, this is the case, and I'm going to make the Berry phase look like this, but we need to identify what this general parameterization is. So I was looking through various papers, and I found there is a general parameterization that Wooters and Chan wrote down, which is essentially by exponential. You could write a general expression for a small path by writing a plus dA, and you can exponentiate that expression like so. And you might think you could use that to construct a general form of the Berry phase. But that's not actually what we did. So what we did was something different. So it turns out you can write a generic point on the manifold in this way. So this here is some reference MPO. It can be any, actually, any MPO. But let's just say it's a reference MPO. And then I have, and this is the environment, actually, to the right of my state. It's the square root of the environment tensor. And this is some tensor. It's the same dimension as a usual matrix product tensor, actually. And if you write this thing down, with these constraints, it turns out the Berry phase has the simple form I wrote down before. Now, one way to interpret this is the following. So when I wrote down my matrix product operator before, I said we should act on a particular reference state. But actually, which is to say that this index would take some particular value. And that would be our matrix product state. But in fact, that index could take any value, and each value that it takes would describe for us a perfectly good matrix product state. And in fact, what this MPO contains is a set of orthogonal matrix product states. And taking some superposition of these orthogonal states, a general superposition of these orthogonal states, gives you this thing here. So this reduces to the CP1 at bond order 1. This is literally just the CP1 representation of our spin. Okay. And actually, if you do this, then you can write the partition function. One doesn't need to introduce this extra environment tensor. The integral can be written entirely as an integral over this this generalized CPM representation. Okay. Well, since Anoush is here, I thought I might say one little slide about many-body localization. So one could think about taking some Hamiltonian and diagonalizing it in the usual way with some matrix product operator. Now, let me restrict myself to a set of states, and this is a restriction, but restrict myself to coherent states or product states of L bits. So I'm going to take a coherent state here and use this matrix product operator to convert it into the physical state. And if I do that, actually, the Berry phase is just the Berry phase of these reference coherent states. And you can see that this is taking something, this is giving me a local expression for something that is actually very non-local, because the spin here might have an influence over, or the L bit here might have an influence over a very large region of the physical spin space. And yet I've been able to write the Berry phase in just terms of rotations of these local fields. So this general expression we have for the Berry phase, it's a local expression, but it's remarkable that one can frame this in a local way at all. So we're talking about dynamics of entanglement that is all about non-local physics, yet there's a parameterization that makes that very local. Okay. I think I'm going to spend maybe 2 minutes. Is that acceptable? Just going quickly through a discussion. So I've mentioned a few times about trying to extend this to higher dimensions and how it's very difficult because the PEPs are not finitely contractible. But we can make some progress, it turns out. So if instead of using matrix product states, if we just use some finite depth circuit, these are finitely contractible by design. The one price we pay for that is that our parameterization is not translationally invariant. So you know, such a network, such a circuit could describe all local singlet and magnetic order, just as the ANSATS MPS state did that I wrote down before. But but our parameterization here is breaking translation invariance. So that might make it trickier to use, but one can work with this, it turns out. And that has the advantage that actually we write down a similar construction, we can work with this in any dimension. And that's how we're beginning to look at this JQ model at the moment, constructing a field integral over these types of states. In fact, it's easier to write down a field integral over these states than it is the matrix product states, or path integral over these states. Of course, these mirror are finitely contractible as well, as one of the reasons they were written down, I guess. So in principle, the field theory over mirror is a local field theory. And actually, one might hope that if you construct a field theory over some finite depth circuit, like so, what you end up with in the end is a path integral that looks just like a conventional path integral, just with some extra fields involved. And so all the usual techniques that we apply to such field theories, renormalization group and so on, we can apply here. And of course, some of the fields that we have are entanglement fields. So if we apply our conventional renormalization techniques to these entangled path integrals, we are automatically renormalizing entanglement. And it would be fascinating to see how such a field theory renormalization of a field integral constructed over these states might connect to these ideas, these exciting ideas that are being developed here and elsewhere, I suppose. And you know, of course, there have been lots of approaches to renormalizing tensor networks, and I think it's quite exciting to see how this might work. I'm particularly interested in seeing how it might connect to the quantum renormalization group of Sunset. Final thing, one thing we have written down recently, if we can construct a field integral or a path integral, we can construct a Keldysh path integral. And so we can begin to think about out of equilibrium properties of such states, or if you like, the effect of the environment on systems and how the entanglement structures is affected by the coupling to the environment. So this is what I've written down here is a Langevin equation that you get if you couple a matrix product state description of a spin chain, if you couple that to local harmonic baths, one can extend the time-dependent variational principle, which are essentially the noise and dissipation free equations of motion, and you can supplement that with some fluctuation and dissipation parts. And through this, one can hope to see how the entanglement structure actually evolves in such open systems. Okay, I think I'll finish there. We've been trying to construct these path integrals over tensor network states, and we've managed to do it in 1D, and we think it can give some new insights, and it gives a complementary way of looking at certain physics, particularly physics that involves singlets in spin systems, and we're exploring extensions to higher dimensions. Thanks.
Any questions?
I have two questions. The first one is very technical. So in the path integral, I noticed that there's always a delta functional in integration. Does it mean that we always need like ghosts to handle these integrations?
So, interestingly, let me go back to which version. I could go to this one, or even better, perhaps, if I went to Yeah, now let me go back to this version. So yeah, there's always these types of delta functions. And so, for example, if I went to bond order one, I wouldn't need this delta function. I'd have this. This will be the usual constraint that the field has length one. And the one would introduce some Lagrange multipliers, perhaps, to deal with that. Now, so the whole story of deconfined critical points, for example, is that precisely the breakdown of those constraints that mean of the mean field imposition of those constraints means that you have to deal with the dynamics of those constraint fields. The point is, and there are aspects of this that are still an open question. But the point is that another way of saying this is that these entanglement and tunneling between spin configurations becomes important. And that's actually why you have to deal directly. You can't treat the constraint on at a mean field level. But if we construct a field theory that has some higher bond order, we're already capturing that physics. So one might imagine that the treatment that deals with those constraints at mean field level is good in the presence of effects that would mean you can't do that in the product state description. So yes, in principle, one needs to introduce ghosts or whatever or Lagrange multipliers to deal with these constraints. But the assumption, I guess one should call it at this point, is that a mean field treatment of those constraints is less severe here than it would be in the product state. And in fact, if you go to higher bond order, perhaps those constraints become weaker and weaker.
So the second question is about the Sapatnikov treatment of a J1, J2 model 1.
Yes.
So there, I'm under the impression that you're looking at a simple bond order 2 MPS.
Bond order 3. So we need bond order 3 because to capture the Majum de Gauche.
Right.
I mean, each configuration will be bond order 2, but you need to be able to add them together.
So I was wondering whether one could arrive at the same type of mathematical expression by using, say, Schwinger boson?
It will be tricky.
Simple MPSs, I mean, not these higher.
It's trickier in the J1, J2 case. But in the VBS and Nail case, you can certainly get to what we've got by using a Sajdev BAT bond operator description. So you simply you make a choice of symmetry breaking. You say on these bonds, we're going to describe all the singlet and triplet configurations, and then you can construct a field theory over those. And that essentially gets you the same physics. In fact, it looks almost identical if you do that. The point is, in the J1, J2 model, you need to be able to describe this equal superposition of these two, and it's a translational invariance of the matrix product description that allows you to do that. So precisely this dimerization is the breaking of that symmetry, and it's that symmetry, or let's say the breaking of that degeneracy by these zero-point fluctuations. So there may be, of course, if you can write down the... If you can treat in one way, there probably is another particular set of particular parameterization for that particular problem that will get the same result. And it may indeed be neater for a particular problem. But I think, in general, this gives you a sort of prescription for trying to write down such a field theory.
So you argue that if you consider higher and higher orders, and presumably the fluctuation for these instanton effects become less and less severe.
Yes.
So for the simple coherent, say spin coherent, Pasternak, we have a sort of a tuning parameter which is the spin quantum number.
Yes.
So then there we clearly see that for large S, we can really just look at subtle points and fluctuations along subtle points.
Yes.
So in this case, do you think there's a similar controlling parameter there that control the severeness of quantum fluctuations?
Well, of course, S must control those quantum fluctuations. They're the same quantum fluctuations, after all. So S must be a parameter also. So it's the same control parameter. I mean, that control parameter is a physical control parameter, which is controlling the strength of quantum fluctuations. So the same control parameter works here. It controls, you know, those the important fluctuations you need to suppress are these instanton type configurations. And so it controls in a similar way.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay, so then let's thank Andrew again for the talk.